that Jason?
Yes, it is Jason. Am I speaking to Lamal?
You are. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Is that you on the photograph on the bottom of the page on countdownmemories.com?
Yes, it is.
Is that an old photo?
Is that the one with Molly Meldrum?
Yeah.
It's about 3 years old.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I just wanted to say, it's been a long time since you've been to Australia, 1984, actually. Are you really looking forward to coming down for the Ultimate 80s concert?
I'm dead excited. I'm really excited because coming back after so long, and also, you know, people really have strong memories with my two big hits, particularly.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful to be able to share that with people. It's like the connection from, you know, the CD they bought or some people tell me sometimes it was the first record they bought or whatever it is. And then if you can connect with that in a live situation. And this is a fun live situation because you've got all these other artists. We're going to be a little family, you know, thrown in together, travelling together. It's going to be great. I'm really excited. And, of course, most of the cities I've never been to before.
Yeah.
So, you know, I hope I get a feel of them and get a chance to experience them a little bit.
Absolutely. And going back to the very beginnings, you, of course, started in Kajagoogoo and the way that, I guess, you got into the band, was it through an ad in a paper?
Yep. Yeah, it's strange because they were looking for a singer and I was looking for a band. And apparently they'd had an advert in looking for a singer about 2 weeks before my ad went in, but I never saw it.
And okay.
So I got a call from the bass player and he said, hi Lamal, I know you're looking for individual musicians to form a band because we are already a band and we haven't found the singer we're looking for. Would you be prepared to still come up and see us?
Yeah.
So that's how it came about.
Fantastic. And of course the first single that Kajagoogoo released was Too Shy and it went straight to number one and produced by Colin Thurston who worked with Duran Duran as well. Now how did the process of meeting Nick Rhodes come about?
I was a waiter in a nightclub in London called the Embassy Club.
Yep.
And Nick Rhodes, it was quite a few music people used to go there. Nick Rhodes came in, I think he was with their manager, Paul Barrow, and I served him a drink. Then I got chatting, very enthusiastic about the band, and to my surprise, he said, well, look, why don't you send me a tape? It was tapes back then.
Yeah.
And he said, and I'll tell you what I think. And then a couple of weeks later, he rang me up and he said, I've got your tape, Lamal. I really like it. I'm going to take it into EMI and tell them I want to produce you.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah, off the floor.
Wow. That's amazing.
Time. touch eye to eye, too shy, shy, hush, hush.
And every career needs a lucky break, and really that was one of the main pieces of the jigsaw puzzle, if you like.
Yep. Fantastic. And what was it like working with Colin Thurston?
Colin was very meticulous. He was quiet. He was very confident. He was successful. He knew his role. He was an old school engineer, had been through, you know, technical college about audio and all that stuff. And he had lots of little tricks, you know. He knew what equalizer and compressors and all that technical stuff to put on the drums, and, you know, highlighting stuff with echoes and delays. It was I felt confident because, you know, he produced the first album by Duran, which at the time was very, very successful.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And you, of course, followed up Too Shy with the singles Ooh To Be Ah and Hang On Now, and both tracks were absolutely flawless, especially, like, for me, Hang On Now is my favourite Kaja Gugu single. And how did you enjoy, like, following up Too Shy? Was it hard because it went to number one, and then the next two singles, was it hard to reach the same kind of heights without all the pressure?
Well, first thing, Jason, is that, strange you should say that, but my favourite song on that album too is Hang On Now.
Wow.
That song.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I love that song so much. Yeah. It's got a musicality about it that really just is quite deep for me, and I'm always very nostalgic when I, you know, if I perform it or the rare occasion I hear it.
We'll be right back.
about the number one, that there is always going to be that psychological pressure that the next one has to be number one.
Mm-hmm.
It's the number 5, 6, 7, 8. It's like, does it feel like it's a failure? When of course it isn't, because any top 10 record is, especially back in those days, you know, a top 10 really meant something then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, just wanted to say, U2BR was actually played quite a lot in Australia on the show Countdown. So, do you think there's any chance of doing something like U2BR, or especially Hang On Now, in the tour of Australia this year, or is it just going to kind of like? Do you know how many tracks you're doing?
At the moment, they're talking about the number of songs. I would love to do those two songs. I have to do the two big hits.
Yeah.
And I have scope to do others.
Yeah.
So, I always have to do Too Shy and Never Any Story. I think the audience would lynch me. I find your comment very refreshing. I would love to do Hang On Now and U2BR. I've been into Abbey Road with the permission of EMI and the band. I've got all the original sequences.
Wow.
In a live situation, it sounds fantastic.
Yep.
Definitely.
I also wanted to just...
Can you do me a favour and tell the people at Metropolis what you've just said? Because it's only from feedback from people like you guys that will allow me to, you know, to persuade them. It'll help me to persuade them.
I shall, believe me.
Yeah.
I also wanted to ask, just quickly back to U2BR, the video clip is... really, really interesting with, you've got cameos by Kenny Everett, etc. Where was that filmed?
That was filmed in and around London.
Yep.
And, I think it was done very early, so it was quieter.
Yep.
And, it was, the internal stuff, they rented a place on the Regent Street called the Cafe Royal.
Mm-hmm.
Cafe Royale, and this was like a function room as part of a big events building.
Yeah.
And it was quite formal, quite old school, but it worked well for the video. It was very exciting to be running around London at 24 years old with camera crews and sound crews and technicians.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was just like, all your dreams come true, but even better, you know. I was 24, I was a kid from a small town, my family had no money, and here I am, suddenly, you know, having all this success at 24. It was just brilliant, absolutely brilliant, and it still is.
Yeah. And then we're moving on after the White Feathers album. Obviously, we all know the story, how you were basically booted out of Kajagoogoo.
Yep.
And then you, of course, went solo, and you released your first album, Don't Suppose. And obviously, and I just wanted to say, from that album, I think Only for Love is just such an extraordinary single.
Please tell Metropolis Music.
Well, it was played here a lot on Countdown, and you also performed it on a show at the time called The Bert Newton Show. I don't know if you remember that.
Please tell Metropolis.
Is that your problem? Don't let it show. You will find it self-deceiving.
And of course you had another single off the album called Too Much Trouble, which unfortunately didn't make a lot of impact in Australia, but it was played in the UK quite a bit, and I love that single, and I have to say I love the backing vocals on it. They're just brilliant. No, you can talk.
You know, all those songs are really special to me. I mean, I was just having such a great time being creative and experimenting. And of course, at that point, I'm out on my own. It was very scary, though.
Yeah.
You know, to go from being in the group and being constantly part of a team, and that felt like fun. That was fun because there was always banter.
Mm-hmm.
Jokes and Nick messing about. And then, but I felt really determined because I was angry at the time, you know, the way they fired me in a phone call. And I just thought, right, I'm going to prove myself. Looking back, I really did, I think, you know, but because when you have a sound, it's the sum of the parts, isn't it? There's the four musicians, what they bring to the creative table, and then the singer's input as well. There was a real kind of creative bond.
Yeah.
I did miss that to a certain degree. And I think, but it's interesting how, you know, if I hadn't split from the group, maybe, just maybe, I never would have been offered the possibility to sing The Never Ending Story, which
yeah.
has become such an important song in my career.
Absolutely. I was going to, of course, mention Never Ending Story. You worked with Mr. Giorgio Moroder, who is completely legendary. How did you get to work with Giorgio Moroder, and what was it like working with Giorgio Moroder?
I was asked by EMI Records to go to, after the band split up, they asked me to go to the Tokyo Music Festival. I had no idea what it was. They said it was really important to promote the new single, Only for Love. So I went to the Tokyo Music Festival. It's a huge event at the Budokan Hall, and you know, the previous people involved, you know, were legends like Diana Ross and Lionel Richie and Dionne Warwick and big names. And the year that I went, it's kind of like a competition. It was weird. I never really worked it out, but I had a huge TV audience, and one of the judges of this song contest was Giorgio Moroder.
Yep.
And I partly credit the reason Never Ending Story came about was my old manager, Billy Gaff, who was an entrepreneur in the true sense of the word. He was a character, he was a showman, he was larger than life. He'd managed Rod Stewart through some of his biggest years as a solo artist, and he really knew how to play the game.
Yeah.
And I think Billy took Giorgio to dinner. He sang my praises. Probably convinced Giorgio that I was going to be the next best thing since sliced bread. And when we got back to the UK, I got a call from my manager to say, can you go to Germany and put your voice on this new recording for a film?
Is exactly kind of what you needed at that time going solo as well.
Oh, yes. Funny you should mention it. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it kind of legitimized my solo career.
Yeah.
Or me as a solo performer. Because suddenly, the weird thing about Never Ending Story is it's a tough song to sing. You know, you can't. I think all my theatre work, my previous theatre work, I'd been in Joseph and the Amazing Dreamcoat, I'd been in Godspell, I'd been in three other bands, I'd been singing lessons, I'd done the whole shkaboodle really, and I think all of that came to support me with this kind of demanding vocal role, because Never Ending Story is right at the top of my register, and normally, you know, like if you go and see an opera, for example, and you'll get the soprano singing the top C, the really high notes, but they come for effect every now and then. And with Never Ending Story, it's right at the top of my range. It requires real discipline.
Yes.
You have to be in good voice, I've got to warm it up, and it's been but you see, it paid off, because you know, people do hear that, and they say to me, you know, your voice on that song just sounds great.
Yeah.
It's still lovely to hear that. It really is.
And you then your next solo album after Don't Suppose was Colour All My Days, and you actually got to work with quite a lot of tracks with Giorgio Moroder on that album as well. And I just wanted to say, I think Shock is one of the standout tracks for me.
Oh, Oh, wow. You really are a fan.
Yeah.
Most people just talk about Too Shy and Never Any Story. Yeah, Shock. Wow. That's Shock.
Yeah. That's good.
That album, I mean, it made sense to do a whole album with Georgia when you've just had a song that went to number one all over the world, you know, got a formula that's working. So it made sense to work with Georgia again.
Yeah.
So I flew back to Germany and I was there for quite a few weeks and it was just a joy working with Georgia. He's such a nice guy. When I left the final, after the final recordings were done, I was leaving Germany. He had his own driver, and the driver came to my hotel. He had a Rolls Royce, Georgia, which was a big deal back then.
Yeah.
Probably a lot of them around now. But so the driver comes with a Rolls Royce to my hotel, and I'm given this large gift wrap box. And the message said from Giorgio, he used to call me Lim. That was his little nickname for me. He called me Lim with an Italian accent. Lim. So the message said, Lim, it was a pleasure working with you. Don't ever change. Best, Giorgio.
Wow, you sound so much like him.
I thought he was a bit French. But, I opened this box and there were like 20 individually wrapped bottles of, well, top brand perfume and cologne.
Wow.
Aftershave. And just everything was in there. It was just one of the best presents. And that's how I was left with Georgia. And so, yeah, my memories of the whole Georgia Moroder experience are just fantastic.
That's great. And moving on way, way after the experience with Giorgio Moroder, I remember seeing, maybe about 11, 12 years ago, the bands reunited for VH1 to try to reform Kajagoogoo, which was quite full-on to watch. That, I guess, was, again, the second Kajagoogoo kind of experience for you. What was that like to be put in that kind of situation?
Well, that's 10 years ago now.
Yeah.
I wish I could do that all again because I think I'm just in a better place now mentally about the whole thing. At the time, though, it was really tough. I felt that it was pointless to go over anything. We couldn't achieve anything by that. So I just really put a huge padlock on the emotional baggage closet door. and just dealt with it here and now, and got on with making the program. I think we all saw it as a possible possible route to doing more work and doing work that would be interesting to people. So that makes the whole, that gives the whole kind of weight to what you're doing. And I think that really was our incentive, just to see if we could take that further. It didn't really happen. But one of the, you know, the experience was fantastic. But I can't, I find it difficult to watch the program. I've never watched it since.
Okay. And in 2009, us Kaja Gugu fans were treated with a brand new single called Space Cadet, which was featured on the new Kaja Gugu Best Of CD and DVD. It was very funky, full of rhythm, and like it had a really quite a big kind of live drum sound to it, and the video for it was absolutely brilliant. How do you feel about the single Space Cadet, and were you all pleased to be working on a new single again?
Oh, I loved that song. I loved the video. It was great to make some new recordings. But shortly after that reunion tour, the bass player, Nick, announced that he didn't really want to do any more Kaja Gugu projects.
Oh, okay.
At the time we were all, I still don't really know why. I know that musically he's gone off in this direction that he's interested in, prog rock, fusion, whatever.
Yeah.
But we'd all put quite a bit of energy and time into that reunion, and we, you know, I am still quite disappointed that he can't somehow fit in, you know, in his schedule, whatever he's doing, some bits and bobs for Kaja Gugu.
Because I also heard some other tracks from, you know, what would have been possibly a new Kaja Gugu album. I loved High Life. I think that was just amazing.
Yeah.
Like, such a good track. And was that and I also heard a bit of Death Defying Headlines. Was the album supposed to be called Death Defying Headlines?
Well, it was always a plan to do, like, a taster. And an album felt like too much of a commitment. A single didn't seem like enough, so we just thought we'd go for the EP.
Yeah.
Which is it means extended play, I think.
Yeah.
Of course, that doesn't mean anything to the kids of today, because they never really had vinyl. With downloads, they're not even holding anything anymore. They're not even holding a CD.
Yeah, I think it's terrible.
Yeah, I agree with you. There was something about the smell of vinyl. And
absolutely.
The sleeve and there.
Yes, absolutely. Like every time, yeah, every time I get my vinyl out, like I just, you know, it's nice to smell it, it's nice to look at the artwork, it's nice to look at the notes and everything. It's even amazing to look at the label on the vinyl.
And the technology was amazing, to just take the arm and watch it drop onto this piece of black plastic and then this amazing sound to come out.
I also just wanted to ask one more thing with with your solo material from like Don't Suppose and with White Feathers, Kajagoogoo, etc. Were there any leftover material, demos or anything, or is all that was recorded was recorded?
Well, it's funny you should ask, but after Colour All My Days, I went to New York and I got signed by Clive Davis to Arista Records in New York.
Yep.
And Clive Davis is an industry mogul. You know, in America, he's very revered. And when I got signed by Clive Davis, I was so excited, because he'd signed, Whitney Houston. He signed, you know, he signed so many artists over the years. I think there were books on him. So they recorded 6 songs. They spent $250,000 and they dropped me.
Oh, okay.
And those 6 songs are floating around somewhere in vaults in America.
Wow.
And there have been inquiries about them, but nobody can find them.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, that's unbelievable.
And one of those songs is a Georgia Moroder song.
Wow. Great.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I just wanted to say... Yeah, sorry?
I was just trying to remember the title. I know it's got life in it, but I can't remember the rest of it.
Oh, okay.
It would be really interesting to unearth those recordings, definitely. But there you go.
Wow, thanks. I didn't think there'd be so much floating around, actually.
Did I say 6 recordings or 4?
I think you said 4.
I think it's 4, yeah.
Yeah.
It seems like an amazing amount of money for 4 recordings. What happened was I did it with these Dutch producers that I wanted to work with, and they just had a top 10 in the UK, and Clive sort of reluctantly agreed, because I think he had this idea for American radio, American producers, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And when the mixes came back, he didn't like them. And he said, we have to do it all again. And so that's how the recording bill ended up being $250,000, because it paid for all the studio time and it paid for the original producers, musicians, etc., etc. And then they did it all again, so...
Oh, okay. And I also wanted to ask you about video clips, etc. What would be your favourite video clip you did with Kajagoogoo and your favourite video clip you did solo?
I love Hang On Now.
Yep.
I love the song. So that would definitely be on my list. And solo... I didn't actually make that many videos solo. There was too much trouble. It was only for love. I'd probably say Never Ending Story, because the clips of the film are lovely. They're magical.
Yep. Fantastic. I just want to say thank you so much for talking to me.
You're welcome. I've really enjoyed it. You really know your stuff, and it's so great to speak to someone who really knows all my music like that.
Yeah, and I want to say thank you for all the music, thank you for your voice, because it's extraordinary, and yeah, we're really looking forward to you touring in July, and I really hope that I get to meet you, because it would be brilliant.
Yeah, let's do a selfie.
Okay, Lamal, thanks a lot again for speaking to me.
No, it's been my pleasure, Jason. Have a great day.
You too.
And I love your website.
Oh, wow, thank you.
great that someone's keeping the sort of Countdown memory alive. I'd better run because I think the next interview probably tried to ring at this moment. But
yeah, cool.
Really enjoyed the chat, and I look forward to hopefully meeting you in July.
Okay, thank you very much. Goodbye.
All right, Jason. Bye.
Bye. Like spirit in